Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Happy 300th birthday.
The big 300.
You know, as a big cricket fan, a triple century is like a big deal.
Is that, does it have a name?
A triple century.
Oh, so it's not like called a Googie or a Squididdle?
No. When I was young, Gary Sobers had the cricket record for the highest ever score, I think in Test cricket, which was 365 not out. But then I think it got beaten by somebody who got 499, or by somebody who got more, or maybe it was first class cricket. Anyway, I'm gonna look this up.
You are like a vague stato.
I know, it's like I'm a stato, but without the sort of stats, really. So I write, okay, easy. So Brian Lara scored 501 yes. Not out. Oh no, somebody. DPMD Jayawardena got 374 for Sri Lanka versus South Africa.
We were thinking of doing a competition for the 300th episode, which was win a night out with Ed. But after that, I'm worried that we won't get any entrants.
Well, the second prize will be two nights out with Ed. I was thinking on the way to this recording, you know, did we think we'd be... If we'd said to each other at the beginning, we're going to do 300, do you think we'd have said yes?
I think you might have used your old I'll take it under consideration line.
I think that's true. I mean, it does seem extraordinary. You haven't aged a bit.
No, I've aged a lot.
So how many years is it then? Six?
I think, yeah,
it's six. Five and a bit. Five and three quarters or something.
Yeah, I think so. I made a note of some shows and I thought you could guess whether they have done more or fewer episodes.
Oh, I love your higher or lower. I love your higher or lower sort of malarkey.
Bullseye.
That's a tough one. I'd say fewer.
351, they beat us. Yeah. Grand Designs.
Fewer.
Yes, 212. Strictly Come Dancing. Not Come Dancing in its original iteration, but just the modern Strictly Come Dancing.
Fewer.
366.
Oh, no, more.
Made in Chelsea.
Fewer.
Yes, 282. Last of the Summer Wine.
Fewer.
But only by 295 episodes of that in total. Doctor Who.
More.
Yeah, we're nowhere near 871 episodes of Doctor Who. Yeah. Although 300 individual stories. Mm. So we're on level
pegging. Good research.
Thank you. And I thought that leads us nicely onto Doctor Who.
Doctor Who.
Because...
this is a special, isn't it?
It really is.
Maybe we should title this The Return of the Doctor.
Yes.
I mean, not that the Doctor was ever here before episode 300. Or we could, like, you know, let our creative juices flow, you know, Ed, Jeff and the Daleks.
I mean, that would be a misleading title for it.
What, was there no Daleks on it?
Yes.
Ed, Jeff and the Mystery of the Daleks?
Reform the House of Time Lords?
I always loved their titles. I love the music and I love the titles.
Well, we haven't even said why we're talking about Doctor Who.
Just because we like Doctor Who.
Well, there is that. And our 300th episode features a special guest.
Very special guest.
This is part two of our live show from the Royal Shakespeare Theatre in Stratford-upon-Avon. Last week, you heard what I think was a brilliant conversation about climate education. This week, one of our finest thespians.
David Tennant.
Yes.
I really wish I'd said at the beginning, which rips off a Joan Baez thing that I talked about on the, I think, episode you were aware. I wish I'd said, oh my goodness, you're David Tennant. This is the Royal Shakespeare Theatre. I didn't say that.
It was unbelievable, wasn't it? And he was such a great guest. Do you know, I occasionally meet people or see characters in films and I think there's such a ball of energy and positivity.
Yeah.
I wish I could be more like that, but my fundamental personality undermines it somewhat.
And you don't think I'm in that category, obviously.
I think you have your moments.
Right, yeah.
But he was just wonderful.
I think he's got incredible charisma, actually. You know how they say about Jeb Bush, he's low energy, or Donald Trump used to say he's low energy. David is exactly the opposite, isn't he? He's just high energy.
But so sort of positive with it as
positive,
well.
Positive, positive.
He's yeah. infectious.
Infectious.
Yes.
I'm proud to have it as the 300th.
Absolutely.
What's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is, did your lads ever go through a horrible histories phase?
Yes-ish.
Okay, so Gina's been mad on it for a while, and we've recently discovered the sitcom that the cast of Horrible Histories went on to do, Ghosts, which is a great family sitcom. Have you watched it?
I haven't, no.
Very late to the party on this. In fact, I think the fifth and final series is airing on the BBC this year. But the premise is that a couple inherit a big stately home that is inhabited by the ghosts of previous occupants of that land, dating back to a caveman. But only the wife can see the ghosts, the husband's
gone.
And yeah, it's great fun. And it is.
So it's like an educational rent-a-ghost. Rent-a-ghost.
Yeah, I mean, there's not much education.
And you
in
let
it, but
your spirits move.
Oh, if they ever do a reboot, I think you'd be a great Mr. Meeker.
Right. Anyway, I just loved Rent-a-Ghost as a child. But anyway, Ghosts or Ghost, is it?
Yes, yeah. I think there are so few things that are real family shows these days, and I think it absolutely fits that bill.
I love that. You sounded quite Mary Whitehouse there. There are so few things that are family shows.
Don't get me wrong, there's a little bit of innuendo in it for the adults, a bit of nudge, nudge, wink, wink. I was thinking about that earlier. I was trying to describe what a family sitcom was to my wife, and I was talking about watching Are You Being Served as a kid, and the innuendo in that show, that wasn't double entendre, yeah. That was single entendre, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point, actually.
So, yes, recommended. What's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is you.
Oh, so you couldn't think of a reason to be cheerful and you're just yeah. saying that in a panic then. You forgot to come up with
yeah,
one.
That's more or less true. No.
I meant to say, actually, when you asked me my reason to be cheerful, what I actually meant to say, it was you and...
No, too late.
This incredible achievement of 300 episodes.
I think, you know, you rescued me from oblivion, but it's been a blast. I'm not saying that because we're about to stop, but it's been a blast.
Likewise.
Oh, I've got a reason to be cheerful.
Oh, so can we just delete that?
No, because I can leave that one in. I met somebody on a train and I was, you know, I've been peddling this like confectionery machine, healthy confectionery machines.
Yes, a vending machine that has healthy food in it.
I finally discovered somebody who was sort of taking it seriously. He was in that sort of broad line of work. And I think they've got some line in machines, maybe. But he was one of the first people not to sort of laugh my idea totally out of court.
I'm worried about you, Ed. I'm worried it's some kind of confidence trickster and he's going to ask you for £1,000 and then
you'll
never hear from him again.
That is possible. That is possible. Anyway, he came up to me on a train. And so that's just a sort of half reason to be cheerful.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful, live. Welcome to the stage, Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyds.
Good interval. Do you want us to just get on with it and get David Tennant out?
Yeah, I think so. Most of them have come for David Tennant.
Yes, yeah, let's give them what they want. Yeah. Please welcome David Tennant. Look at him!
Hey.
You're so spry!
He's so young.
Once we're down, we can't get back up again. No. Hello. Yeah.
It's David Tennant.
Hello.
David, Ed was really keen to talk to you because, you know, you were in this role in the early part of this century and somehow you've managed to get back there. Uh-huh. Ed, are you looking for some pointers?
I'm not, no.
Yeah. You are reappearing as the Doctor, is that right? In the 60s.
It's true. It's a cat's out of the bag, yeah. Well, I've already reappeared. I am the current Doctor. I am currently.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
He is both the 10th and the 14th Doctor.
Thank you, Jeff. That's yes. correct. Yes. Yeah. Well
my, done. My son has become a Doctor Who fanatic these past few months since that episode. And I was really torn about whether to bring him today. Right. But my wife really doesn't want him to become any kind of Nepo baby. So she forbade me from bringing him.
Right.
But can we just record a little video for him? Now, I thought this could be a bit of a surprise. So if I tell him somebody wants to speak to him and I'll point it at Ed, then you can say something. Yeah. He'll be disappointed.
Yeah, okay, I'm the disappointment. You're the same.
What's his name?
He's called Gene. Eugene. He's Eugene. 7.
Okay. Gene to his yeah. friends, yeah.
Okay, there we go. Hello, Eugene. I have somebody here who wants to speak to you.
Hi, Gene. How are you? So nice to see you.
Forget about that, Gene. Hello! Hi, Gene, how are you? Me and a few hundred of my closest friends want to say hi to you. Say hello to Gene! I hear you're a Doctor Who fan, which means you have great taste, so I just wanted to drop by and say, allons-y, nice to meet you. Here's back to your boring old dad.
Oh, he's going to love it.
Great.
He's going to love that.
I think I played my role well?
You did, yeah. Ed,
Decoy. That was the role.
Disappointment, I think, yeah.
Because Ed had aspirations to be an actor at school, didn't you?
Yeah, I don't think so.
On the podcast a few times, you've given us a to be or not to be.
Oh, God. No, I definitely
this
don't.
This is the place to do it, Ed.
Definitely.
What is the key to that line?
How many times have you done the line?
Only as many times as I did that play. So, I don't know. I mean...
Hundreds.
No, probably about 100. I mean, that was about... Yeah. We probably did about that many performances. I think with all these things, it's getting rid of the expectation of history. The chant along Shakespeare's greatest hits element. And just try and make sense of it. Just
but you
try
know
and,
everybody's sort of waiting
I
for
know,
it,
I know, they
you?
Are a little bit, yeah. Yeah, and and you can't really deny the audience that either, because it is a bit like...
It's like sort of me and a bacon sandwich type of thing. You know? And you just can't deny
it's the greatest them. Hits.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yes, it would be like going to see the Proclaimers and they don't sing 500 Miles. You know, you're kind of... They've got to be there. But we did cut a bit from the middle of To Be or Not To Be.
Yeah, because I always thought it was a bit flabby.
Exactly. We just wanted to spice it up a bit. And that was partly because there is a bit in the middle, who would Fardels bear? That's quite hard for a modern audience to really follow.
And who would what?
Who would Fardels bear? There's a bit where it goes, who would do this? Who would Fardels bear? It's just
who's
the
Fardels?
Language gets... Exactly, who's Fardels? The language gets a little chewy. And I think... You know, we're doing these plays for now, so make them accessible. Don't rewrite them, but you're going to take bits out of them anyway. And I quite like the idea of taking a bit out of the middle of the most famous speech in history. Nobody noticed. And it was just a way of feeling like we were being a little
presumably
bit
that's
punk
because
with
they're
it.
All waiting for the line.
Well, because who would Fardels bear? Nobody remembers yeah. that bit. But To Be or Not To Be, the first chunk everybody remembers. And then it slips into kind of a vague memory of what it's... But it's actually... That speech in particular is quite hard to make actual sense of. It's quite... It goes to quite philosophical, slightly esoteric, slightly... The sense of it does slightly slip, which arguably is the point of what Shakespeare was... The point that he was trying to make, you know, as Hamlet struggles for meaning. All you're trying to do as an actor in that moment is communicate the sense of it, which is all you're ever trying to do. But that's the bit you have to reach for to not get caught in the weeds of the chant-along aspect. You know.
What's your history with the RSC? You were involved from pretty young.
Yeah. Yes. I'm getting on for 30 years ago now, yeah.
And who were the titans who were still around at that time?
In the first play that I did here, which was As You Like It, we had John Woodvine playing Jacques, who was a great sort of RSC stalwart. I mean, he still is. He was then, later on, he was in Hamlet as well. So he was probably our oldest luminary sort of. And that's one of the great things about a company like this. You have actors who've been with the company for decades, often.
And how did it all start for you, getting into the business of acting?
I went to drama school. I decided I was going to do it. At home in Paisley, with very few precedents or any real notion as to how one would go about it.
From what age did you
think? I would probably about 3 or 4.
3 or 4?
I know, it doesn't really make sense, does it? I've got a 3-year-old at the moment, and she's so kind of carefree and crazy and bananas. I think, how was I having conversations about acting? This doesn't seem like...
Who are your role models at that point? Jeffrey from Rainbow? I mean, who is a 3-year-old looking at?
Butt bungle.
Well, with sort of withering inevitability, it was watching Doctor Who. And that's why I can date it. Because the thing that I remember is John Pertwee turning into Tom Baker, which was in 1974.
Yeah.
And I was 3. And I know I saw that because I remember it. And I remember... coming out of that, a conversation about what actors were, about that it was people pretending. And I remember from that moment, on some very sort of basic level, thinking, I'll do that then.
And when did it become more...
It just very gradually grew up with
me. You did it at school?
Me.
You did it...
A little bit, not much.
Was it seen as sort of weird to be into this at school, or not really? Or
it didn't
were you
seem...
encouraged?
Though I was neither encouraged nor discouraged. There really wasn't anyone around... who knew anything about it. So there
school
was
plays and stuff?
A little bit, when they happened, but there weren't a lot of them in our school. There was a couple, and I certainly got involved where I could. It's not like my parents were in it. There was nobody who could tell me what the route was. But luckily, the idea sort of evolved with me. There was a drama school in Glasgow, which was only sort of 5 miles away from us,
so I
quite quickly decided I'd go there.
After school?
I started doing school. Saturday morning classes there, and then at 17 left school and went to drama school. Yeah.
And as you move through your career and you met people from different backgrounds, are you struck by how possible that path would have looked if you're from a more privileged background?
Well, certainly possible. I don't know how possible. I suppose of course if you're from an acting family, which is now the family that I, you know, we now have children who are from an acting family.
Yeah.
And I suppose, yes.
Are they forming them into a troupe? Is there any...
We're going on tour as the Von Trapps, the Von Tennants. Yes, I suppose it is. Yes, it's a different route. I mean, my wife's an actor too, and her parents were both actors. So yes, there was a sort of different way in, I guess.
What did your parents think about it as you were growing up and going on about being...
sort of whimsy.
Yeah.
Because... I think at first they thought, "Oh, that's funny, that's nice," without any sense that it's what I would actually do. And then when they realised I was quite determined, they were like, "Well, let's make sure you do a course where you could become a drama teacher, where it could sort of transition quite sensibly, where it could transition into something where you could actually
have the hope
of making a living." Yeah. So they were always quite keen. Not to discourage me, but to make sure I had other options, other sort of escape hatches.
And you started in a socialist theatre company called 784, is that right?
My first job was with 784, Scottish People's Theatre.
What was 784?
Well, 784 famously is named after the statistic that 7% of the population own 84% of the wealth. So it was formed as an agitprop theatre company, yeah. And it was still going strong in Glasgow when I graduated from drama school. It wasn't quite at the sort of pointy end of its activism by then, but it was still doing... I mean, the first play I did with them was a Brecht play. We did a production of The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy, which is a play about warning against the rise of fascism, yeah. That's not specifically why I took the job. I mean, straight out of drama school, you'll take anything. Had there been a sort of right-wing equivalent, I might not have felt terribly comfortable, but I would probably have said yes. I don't know what that play would have been about.
Were you idealistic? Were you politicised?
I was, yes. I mean, certainly I've always had what I would just take to be a sense of the obvious, you know, the sense of being awake to the idea of community and an idea of the sense that we're all in it to look out for each other. My father was a minister in the Church of Scotland, which I suppose arguably has a certain theatricality to it.
Parallels with Gordon
like
Brown.
Gordon Brown.
Like Gordon Brown. Exactly like Gordon Brown, yeah. Both sons of the manse.
And you went to listen to him every Sunday?
Yeah, yeah. And he wasn't political with a capital P, but he certainly was. I mean, I think if you preach the gospel, you preach a sort of form of socialism, I would argue. You know, it's about looking out for each other. It's about community. It's about making sure that the least in society is looked after by everyone else, and that there are safety nets, and that we care for each other, and that we are kind. Please, God. There's a lack of that around these days. So I suppose if any sense of morality, and you know, and I'm not particularly religious anymore, but I certainly took from it the morality of that, certainly.
And did you, when you became Doctor Who,
yeah,
did you feel like it was realising the sort of aspiration you had at three when you'd seen John Pertwee turn into Tom Baker? Or was it wrong to put it?
It was a very odd, because obviously Doctor Who had been off air for a long time, so even though it had been an early inspiration for me, it wasn't something I really imagined I would ever be part of. 2005 is when it came back. Yeah. And that's when I got cast, because I came in at the end of that first series. It was just very odd and surreal. Surreal that this show that I'd loved as a kid so much was back at all. And then that I was involved in it.
Did you get tapped on the shoulder?
Kind of, yeah. I happened to be working with Russell T Davis, who was the writer, showrunner, on a show called Casanova that he'd written, which was a mini-series about Casanova. So I was getting to know him, and at the same time, he was making the first series of Doctor Who. So I would keep going, come on, you've got to just put me in it somewhere. I'll be in a Cyberman suit, just please. And he was weirdly resistant. And I thought, that's just rude. Because there's lots of lovely parts. You've cast me as Casanova. You can't think I'm rubbish. Why are you not? And then towards the end of filming, he said, come round to my house. I've got some rough cuts. You're a fan. You'll enjoy this. So I went round to his house and saw a rough cut of the very first episode. And then a rough cut of the episode with the Dalek, which was episode 6. He showed me these two. And I was just in heaven, I'm thinking, just sitting back and had it thinking, what a treat to be one of the first people in the country to get to see the new iteration of the show that was such an inspiration to me that I've loved. And at the end of that, himself and Julie Garner, the exec producer, was there as well, who was, again, the exec producer of both shows. As the tape ran out, they sort of said, so we invited you around because we want you to see this, but obviously we've also got a bit of a proposition. At which point they said, how would you feel about taking over? And at this point, there was no sense that Chris Eccleston wasn't going to stay for a long time. And it was an out-of-body experience, to be sure. And I laughed. I found it hysterically
funny.
It's like
me ringing up people, as I used to have to do, as leader of the opposition, to say, would you like a peerage? people often had a strange reaction.
How come you never offered David a peerage?
I know, it was an oversight. Things might have been different.
Yeah.
So go on.
Yeah, and I laughed. I found it hysterically funny. But then Russell T Davis, grew up as a massive fan of Doctor Who. He was hugely inspired to do what he did and is now doing again because Doctor Who meant so much to him as a child. So he had already gone on the journey that I was sort of now
What
on.
Did you think as you walked away that evening? Did you say yes on the spot?
No, I didn't, because Russell wouldn't let me. Because he very wisely went, don't say anything now. Have a good old think about this, because this you'll have a myriad reactions to this over the next few days, which is exactly what I did. I went from going, this is absurd, this is amazing, to then thinking that I can never do this. What if I break it? To also think, because at the time it hadn't been on, and there was a sense in the world that bringing back Doctor Who might be a terrible.
So it hadn't yet come back.
Hadn't been on yet. It was imminent. Yeah. It was about to happen. And my agent at the time. She's retired now, although she was one of the finest agents in the business, but she did go, you are not doing that. That is a terrible idea. To be fair, she later revised her opinion. But for a while I thought, I'm going to do it, then I'm not going to do it, and then I definitely wasn't going to do it. It was a terrible idea. And then I woke up one morning about 10 days later and went, oh, well, I can't let anyone else do it. So I'm going to have to do it. And even if it is a terrible idea, it'll be my terrible idea. And luckily, it seemed to work out.
What do you think about your mindset meant that it was such a positive experience for you, because it can end up defining people, and you get the sense that across a lifetime people make peace with it, but sometimes they can want to run from it. What did you clock that meant you...
Has it been bad for anyone who's done it then?
Well, I think some of the actors, I mean, I don't go that deep on it, yeah, but it seems to me that people want to keep it at arm's length for a while, and, you know, the passion of the fans can be very exciting, but it can be a bit all-consuming as well.
It's a lot, yeah. I mean, it's a hugely popular show, and it does define your life to an extent. I've been very lucky to go on and do lots of other things, and Doctor Who has played a part in allowing some of them to happen, for sure. But you are aware, I think, when you take something like that on, and certainly maybe because I'd loved the show and grown up with it and was at various times in my life fairly obsessed with it, I was aware that it would cast a long shadow. And that's part of the calculation when you take it on. But maybe because I always loved it and still do love it, that felt like a fairly small price to pay, I suppose.
So were you watching it the next series after you left? Were you watching it from episode one, or did you need a bit of space from it?
I couldn't not. I was too... And it's that's a weird thing as well.
After you left?
Yes.
You were carrying on watching it?
Of course! We watch it every
You're still
week.
A member of the Labour. In fact, you're in the shadow cabinet. Yeah.
I know it's true, but I mean, I'll be honest with you. The thing I hate the most is having to go to Prime Minister's questions and watch someone else having to do it.
Right.
I feel deep sympathy for him.
Right.
And I wonder just if being the doctor was a more positive experience.
Well, maybe that is true. Maybe that's true. That's so interesting.
Oh, no, it's part of our... It's a family ritual. We still watch it. Two of my kids are here today. We watch it all the time, don't we, kids?
wow.
Yeah.
And you've never resisted going back, because you've gone back a number of times, haven't you, to take part in Christmas episodes and other things?
I did one special when the show was 50.
Yeah.
And I've gone back to do these three specials because the show's 60.
Yeah.
And I can still run. And hopefully, if they ask me back in 10 years' time, I wouldn't need CGI to make my legs move.
And was it hard to leave? You did it for how many years?
I did sort of three full years and then a bunch of specials.
So are you asking him if he wanted to go?
No, but I mean...
That's something for that guy over there.
That's a very specific reference, yeah. Jeff.
I can imagine thinking you're going to move on from it is also quite hard.
It's difficult, yeah. It is difficult. And at the same time, it's, like we've said already, it's a lot and it's all-consuming. So, and then, you know, it opened a lot of doors too. So,
yeah.
So part of you as the kind of young, hungry... Well, I was younger... A hungry actor in their mid-30s thinks, well, I've got to capitalise on this too. I've got to see what else there is in the world. And I went off and played Hamlet at the RSC. So, you know, it allowed me to do things like that, which might not have been possible otherwise. So it's difficult to leave because it was such a positive experience, but also you feel like now's the time. And it was absolutely the right time to go. And it's been lovely to revisit.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And Macbeth next.
Yeah.
At the Donmar.
Yeah, that's right. Not at the RSC. I feel slightly, sitting on the stage of the RSC, I feel slightly.
Oh, is there some kind of etiquette breach going on here?
I'm not sure. Nobody from the RSC has phoned me up and told me off yet. But there is a bit of a. But, you know, the Donmar asked. The RSC are doing Macbeth any minute. They never asked. I don't know who's doing it either. Probably someone marvellous.
Have you done Macbeth before?
I've done it on the wireless. But
on
I've
the
not,
wireless?
I've done it on the wireless, but I've not done it in the actual... Where, like where I don't remember the words.
What's it like doing it on the... When did you do it on the wireless?
Not that long ago, actually. Quite recently, yeah.
Do people still call it the wireless?
No, I... just me.
Am I supposed to say the name of that play on stage, or have I just cursed us?
I don't care, but there's probably people backstage who are now doing various rituals to cleanse the place. There's salt being thrown around.
So just so we know, when does it start and all that?
I think it opens middle of December. Runs over Christmas. It's effectively a pantomime.
Oh, no, it isn't. Sorry.
And are you looking forward to it?
I'm looking forward to it with trepidation, yes. I'm very excited. But also, you know, these they're big old things. They're sort of Olympic events for actors, these big parts. And it's a huge thriller. When I look back on Hamlet now, it's probably the thing I'm most proud that I've done, playing Hamlet for the Royal Shakespeare Company. But at the time, it was terrifying. I mean, the levels of anxiety was awful.
And how did you manage it?
Yeah, how did you manage that?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, the first preview, I was Lynn Darnley, who was the wonderful head of voice at the RSE, and a wonderful woman, died not long ago and is hugely missed. She found me on the floor of my dressing room in the fetal position before the first preview. And were it not for Lynn, I don't know that I'd have made it on stage. So, these things are...
What did she say to get you out of the fetal
position?
She
said, I can't remember. But whatever it was soothing and helpful and got me out there. I think she reassured me that she'd seen other people finding it just as difficult. Because that's the thing, you imagine, Kenneth Branagh's not like this, you know. Olivier found it easy. All that, you know, you suddenly find yourself... You're at the RSC. You're in the. You've somehow managed to elbow your way into this line of people who've had the great honour to play this part.
So even now, you get a sort of imposter syndrome.
I think it gets worse. Yeah, I don't think that gets any easier.
Why does it get
even
worse?
With a track record?
Yeah, maybe that. I don't know, maybe it feels that you've got further to fall or something. I don't know. Or maybe you're just getting older and you're worried your brain will stop working. I'm not entirely sure what it is.
How quickly can you go from, say, one of your kids on the phone saying, Dad, the wireless router's not working, to on stage and in character?
Depends when you switch your phone off before you go on stage. I mean, that's part of it, I suppose. It's a different job once you have a family. In a lovely way, it means you've got another point of concentration. Because you can get quite... Actors can be a little self-obsessed and a little pleased with themselves and a little, perhaps a little self-important sometimes. And although it is important and we do care deeply about what we do and you know, we'll take great efforts to make sure we do it as well as we possibly can, you know, being a dad is ultimately more important. So it does put things in perspective.
Do you have a sort of ritual you do before you go on stage?
I will develop rituals depending on what the show is. I'm not superstitious, and yet clearly I am a little bit, because but each show will have its own rituals.
What, you remember one off
they're
the top
not,
of your
they're
head?
They're not weird. They're not...
Like listening to a certain song?
Yeah, exactly. Horseshoe. Listening to a certain... I'll usually have an album that I have to play from the half-hour call onwards.
What was the last album you used for that?
It was Miles Davis, actually, weirdly, because the last play I was doing was... I had lots of I had a musical soundtrack going under it, a lot of which was jazz, so it ended up... It wouldn't usually be something that specific, that linked to the show. Usually it would be more of a mood I was sort of chasing. Hamlet was a Coldplay album. It's also sort of slightly random. I sort of land on something and then it becomes... that's where I suppose the superstition comes in. I've landed on this as my album for this show and therefore it always has to be. And it doesn't necessarily make sense. But the last play I did was about someone who was slightly... It was a sort of memory play and they were remembering things through music and so a lot of that was jazz. So I ended up on with a piece of jazz playing before the show every night.
Are you geared up for Mania later this year? Will it feel different once Doctor Who is back on air, the 60th anniversary, once those episodes are airing? Does it feel different to you being out in the world?
When are they airing?
I'm not sure, really. I mean, I'm just there for a minute. I'm holding the coats until Shuti Gatwa arrives, who's going to be... just sensational. I've seen him a little bit on set, and he's breathtaking. So I just feel sort of like I'm holding the coats till he arrives, to be honest.
But of course, you'd never get to play against him, I guess.
Not really. No, it doesn't really work that way. I mean, obviously, I got to when Doctor Who was 50, I got to play opposite Matt Smith and John Hurt, which was thrilling to be opposite someone who's playing the same part. Well, that's a little a different sort of trickle of excitement. But no, I'm sort of it's just well, Catherine Tate's back as well, so the two of us are back. Pretending 15 years never happened. Pathetic, isn't it?
Give us at the end a reason to be cheerful on brand, David. What's your reason to be cheerful?
Do you know what's making me cheerful at the moment? Is that it's Pride Month. And the fact that Pride Month is existing and is flourishing and is something that's happening at a time when the world seems to be getting, in some corners, worryingly intolerant and weirdly backward. And where the word woke is being weaponized. I mean, who doesn't want to be awake? Yeah. For crying out loud. That should be suggested as something to be sneered at. That's an aspiration. And that when I was at school, calling somebody gay was like the worst thing you could be called in the playground. And now we celebrate it. And it makes me a little bit emotional. But that it just gives people a chance to be seen and celebrated and to be just combating some of that snide nastiness that is one target I have to take down. When Target in America have to take down their displays because people are so intolerant. I think we all need to put up our rainbow flags and we need to march and shout. And I didn't expect this to get me this emotional, I'll be honest with you. But you know, you just want... You want your children to grow up in a world that is kind, and you want your children to be kind, and you want your children to be accepted for whoever they are. Whatever they want to be, they should be allowed to be whoever they want to be. Totally and that, right. You know, everyone else just needs to butt out.
Totally right.
So that makes me cheerful.
100% right. That was just brilliant. You're totally right.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So
pleasure.
Much. Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to bring the
tone
down.
Please don't apologise.
You know, it's usually me.
And also, I mean, sometimes it can be me. I mean, it is the biggest single change. We're very similar ages, as we were remarking before we came on stage.
Yeah.
It's the biggest single change in our lifetime, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you think, when you have so many reasons to think the world is getting worse,
yeah.
The way in which the world has progressed...
Yes.
In relation.
When you look at it, when you take a step back and see how far we've come, it does give you hope. And it does, because sometimes when you're right in the middle of day to day, you think, where are we going, guys?
Come we were on. The era of Section 28.
Yeah, all that stuff. Yeah.
But it has to be fought for.
Oh, we have to. Yes, we can't take our foot off the gas. That's the thing. And we can't expect that we will always travel in the right direction towards acceptance. We've all got to be fighting that fight every day.
Totally right. Brilliant. Can we thank the brilliant David Tennant, ladies and gentlemen?
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, one of the things that has sustained us across these 300 episodes is what we receive from you. Please keep emailing us your thoughts on what you've heard and what you would like to hear. You can do it through the website, cheerfulpodcast.com. This comes from Matt Davis, who says... Hi, Jeff and Ed. Hi. And the fantastic team behind the scenes. Firstly, I would like to thank you for keeping me company. I'm currently on a sabbatical from work, cycling around Europe for 4 months. And I have been listening to your extensive back catalogue on the road. How do you feel about listening and cycling, Ed, from a safety perspective?
I think okay if you have bone conductor headphones. I'm glad you asked me that question, Jeff. I'm now an expert on these questions. I don't think you should have the headphones in your ears because then you won't be able to hear the traffic, but they can sit above your ears and then it's okay.
good. And I knew you'd have an answer for that. I knew you'd have an answer for that, yeah. And I knew you would have learned that lesson the hard way.
Yeah.
Matt continues, the amazing stories have been a constant source of inspiration and continue to harden my resolve to work towards a more just society, particularly on climate change. I listened to your episode on the right to disconnect today, and it made me think, even before COVID, I would go above and beyond to separate work from home, taking my shirts into work on a Monday so that I could then commute in non-work clothes. As you might imagine, with this commitment to separation, working from home was bleak, and I was lucky enough to get an exemption to be able to work from the office on mental health grounds. In terms of the right to disconnect, I have found my membership of an advocacy for a strong union has been helpful in being able to disconnect. I think that touches on something we've talked about a few times, a very important role for unions in the future.
Definitely. And I'm sympathetic on the shirts issue.
Do you do that?
I go through phases of cycling in casual clothes. And then they get a bit scrunched up. I haven't quite solved the scrunched up problem.
You need somebody travelling behind you in a van with all your shirts.
I don't think that's very environmentally sound, Jeff.
Do you want to do this next one?
This one comes from Nayan Thakurani, and its subject is garden cities all around the world. Long-time listeners, first-time writer. I'm sending this because I listened to your latest episode on garden cities, and I'm just so excited about this topic. I work as a senior consultant for a small business based in Deptford, London, focused on urban development and regeneration. You'll be pleased to know garden cities are alive and kicking, in practice as well as in theory, as I have a number of live projects around the UK focusing on creating new communities inspired by this idea. Your episode also made me think how concepts in urban development diffuse themselves around the country and around the world, as the garden city has also been known to influence policymakers as far as the Middle East and China. This is a topic known as policy mobility and policy transfer, and I thought it might be as fascinating to your podcast listeners as it is to me. Might I suggest it as a topic for a future episode?
That sounds great. I'm very interested in the idea of policy mobility.
Are we policy mobility? We're sort of policy mobility, aren't we?
Yes, we are. We're a conduit for policy mobility.
And I've got a bonus one on garden cities, and this one comes from Wes Ball, somebody who used to work for me in the Labour Party, and he sent me this text. Ed, I can't believe I worked for you for 4 years and yet you did a podcast on garden cities without thinking of me. In all that time, I clearly failed in communicating my singular intellectual passion. It was a fascinating insight from your three guests, always something slightly different to say. He says, I wrote a short dissertation on it at university. I haven't read it for at least 15 years, but dug it out this afternoon, and I'm shocked to discover that it's quite readable, and I'm not totally embarrassed. So he's attached it below. Always happy to chat garden cities more with you. They are towns designed for healthy living and so much more. So many lessons to learn for the future. And he also says, P.S., when I stopped working for Hillary Benn, he gave me a book of election history, and I gave him a copy of Howard's book. I've been trying to teach you politicians about it for decades. There you
Poor
go.
Poor old Wes. He's been wanging on at you for I don't know how long.
I know. Isn't that sort of slightly... Well, it shows I'm not a very good listener, obviously.
Well, thanks to Wes for adding to that. And finally, this comes from Lav Berrier. The subject is, does Ed normally dress like this? Says, hello, please could you have Ed explain the context behind this photograph? Love from Australia, Lav. Yeah, so I'd like to look at the picture.
Ah, yes. This.
What are we looking at here,
We're
Ed?
Looking at me, Keir Starmer, Anna Sawa, and Colin Smith, MSP, and we are on our way to an offshore wind farm. And we are wearing all of the kit and caboodle.
You really are, but there's a way in which you're walking which suggests some kind of, I don't know, crack squad of adventurers who are about to go in, get their hands dirty and sort out a situation. You're all holding hard hats in your hands, you're wearing high vis, you've got little life jacket things around your neck, and you're sort of staring into the middle distance as if you're a man who's seen a few things.
I think I might be a man trying to make sure I don't fall over, actually.
Well, you're doing a...
Trying to put one foot in front of the other in a stable way.
I think this is the most stereotypically macho picture of you I've ever seen.
You don't mean stereotypically there, do you?
Do I not? It's quite unusual.
Uncharacteristically macho,
yes,
maybe.
Yes,
more to the point.
I think this is one that the Millie fans would really get a kick out of.
Yeah. Well,
I also think it looks like something that will inevitably end up on the pictures round of Have I Got News For You.
Is that a good thing?
I think so.
Compared
yeah.
to some of my other pictures, I think it's not too bad.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet at Cheerful Podcast.
Whoa, ho, ho, we're in the 300th outro, ho, ho.
Can we tell them what happened on the intercom before the show?
Oh, yes, definitely.
So, you know, backstage in a theatre, you will have seen it in shows and stuff. They have an intercom where the stage manager will say, Reasons to Be Cheerful podcast, 5 minutes to stage.
And it sort of makes you feel a bit important, like you're sort of, you know, rubbing shoulders with the big sort of cheeses.
Yeah, treading the board. Treading the board. Oh,
there's our curtain call.
Anyway, the voice came over the intercom, which said, please can we have to the stage David Miliband and Jeff Lloyd? That's David Miliband and Jeff.
Oh.
And then 10 seconds later, it went, that's Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd to the stage, please. They obviously realised what had happened and tried to style it out.
What can you say?
It was a great moment. Another great moment for me was as we left via the stage door, there were some people who'd obviously been hanging around to get a photograph of David Tennant. And then as a consolation prize, they were there to get a photograph with you as well. And a couple of people asked me for pity selfies. Sometimes I can see when people are taking pictures of me, you and them, that they're deliberately framing it in such a way that they'll be able to crop me out later.
Yeah.
But this lady came up to me and she had a poster for the event. There were lots of podcasts and other shows on. It had the names of everybody performing. And she came up to me with this poster and a Sharpie. And she said, I think I vaguely recognise your name from somewhere, so I suppose I'll get you to sign it.
I'm really sorry.
I said, what a lovely thing to hear.
Was she saying it with a sort of humour?
Oh, no, there was no humour.
Oh, God. Jeff, I'm sorry. Shall we thank our guests?
Well, we should thank our guest, David Tennant. Just superb. And we should also thank our hosts, the Royal Shakespeare
Definitely.
Theatre. Definitely. Everyone at the RSC.
And the team was brilliant there.
Yeah, they were just brilliant. So thank you. Emma Corsham is our audio producer and driver on this occasion.
Yep.
Rachel Barmer is our content producer.
Was she the navigator?
Rachel was, yeah. They had the front seats, I had the back.
Yeah, I think that's the right thing to do.
Yes. Rachel's supported by Joe Kenyon at Goldfish. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. Ed Seed composed the music. James Deacon made the idents, and our artwork is designed by
Henry Cullen. I think we should thank everybody who's worked on the show over the years.
Maybe not by name.
No, but
because we have a hard enough job remembering the current
ones. But for getting us to 300.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Absolutely. We salute all of them.
300 not out.
He's been Ed Miliband.
He's been Jeff Lloyd.
And these have been 300
Reasons to Be Cheerful.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.